Yesterday I gave a few examples of what seemed to me to be properly described as non-naturalist, dualist, meaning methodologically dualist, approaches to substantive issues, issues of fact, issues about the world. Now, let me stress again what you know, but I want to make clear, that the advocates of the positions that I'm presenting regard themselves as being paradigm examples of naturalist monism, pure, hard-headed naturalist monism. So when I say that it in fact is non-naturalist epistemological dualism, that is a highly controversial statement, and you therefore ought to take it with a good deal of skepticism, since the prevailing view is exactly the opposite, that this is exactly what hard-headed naturalism is. So, for example, if you read any of the expositions of, say, Quine, Roger Gibson's books, or any of the others, it is described as, just as Quine describes it, as the demonstration of what a naturalistic philosophy would be, philosophy that peels away all confusion and residues of a non-scientific path and just pursues questions of language and mind and reality and so on, strictly from a naturalist point of view, which even called naturalized epistemology and so on. Nevertheless, I'm arguing the opposite, that in fact it's a paradigm example of a new form of dualism, much more irrational than the old form having been incorrect, but nevertheless naturalistic within the framework of the thinking of the natural sciences. Well, the examples that I gave last time had to do with what's called language learning, what I prefer to call language growth, that is the development of language in the mind. And here what was the issue is what Quine calls radical translation. That's a certain paradigm that describes a number of different things. The core thing that it describes is the way the child acquires language. The child acquires language by means of the process of radical translation, so Quine assumes. Radical translation, anyone even sane who thinks about the problem of language acquisition will recognize that the child is presented with certain data, and here's the child, and something is formed in the child's constitution, you know, brain or mind or whatever you want to call it. Quine actually isn't very clear about what is formed here, but it seems that what he has in mind is formal language, that is, a set of well-formed formulas. At least he says that two different theories about what the child has acquired are indistinguishable if they converge in the set of well-formed formulas. So it appears that what he has in mind is that the output of the acquisition process is a set of well-formed formulas. Now that can't really be correct, because you can't have an infinite set in your head. The only thing you can have in your head is a finite characterization of an infinite set. That would be what I was calling an I language, meaning a generative procedure intentionally characterized in terms of the actual form of the algorithm. Okay, and then if you have an I language, the fact of the matter is it does generate a class of expressions, and then it's a further assumption that Quine takes for granted. He doesn't even go this far. He assumes that somehow he doesn't assume the I language either. I mean, I can't really give an exposition of this because it's incoherent in my opinion. But if you want to make the view coherent, you would have to assume that there is some kind of generative procedure formed, which characterizes which characterizes the well-formed formulas. Now, Quine doesn't seem to want to make that move. That is, he regards the question of a generative procedure, what he calls a grammar, as being subject to lethal indeterminacy. That is, there's no question of truth or falsity as to what's the right one. So if there's no question of truth or falsity, obviously it can't be in the child's head, because if it's in the child's head, it's just as real as his arms and legs, let's say. Therefore, if, in fact, the grammar is subject to lethal indeterminacy, it cannot be in the child's head. Therefore, we somehow are going to the class of well-formed formulas without any finite characterization of them, and then we're making guesses about possible finite characterizations. Now, this is all completely incoherent. You know, I'm repeating the words, but they don't mean anything, because you can't have an infinite set in your head. Beyond that, there's the question whether the formal language exists. As far as I know, it doesn't exist anyway. There's no evidence that there is such an object. There's no gap in linguistic theory that's waiting to be filled by the invention of such an object. No one has ever made a proposal as to what such an object would be. So it's pure mystery. But that's somehow the picture. There is a coherent picture, but Quine won't accept it. He thinks there's something definitely wrong with it. The coherent picture is the naturalistic one that I described before. The child gets the data. There's an I language, a generative procedure, but a very specific one. And we'll find out, since it's a real object, it's just as real as the structure of the visual cortex, and we'll use any evidence at all to try to find out what it is. Biological evidence, evidence from other languages, quantum physics, if that turns out to be relevant, anything. Just follow the methods of science, which are completely opportunistic. You look anywhere for evidence. But we're not allowed to do that here, not under the paradigm of radical translation. So the picture is the child goes from data to a class of well-formed formulas somehow without going through a generative procedure that characterizes it. Now, you can't make any sense out of this. Something is missing. And for years, in my case, for 40 years, I've been asking Quine what's missing. And I never get an answer. And there's nothing in the literature that tells you what the answer is. That's where it stands. I can't give a more clear characterization than this. And this characterization is not clear. In fact, it is incoherent. But I don't know how to get beyond the incoherence. That's something intrinsic to this approach, as far as I can see. If somebody knows how to do it, I'd like to hear it. But I've never heard it, and I can't find anything in the literature about it. Well, okay, somehow the child goes from the data to the class of signals or well-formed formulas or something like that. Quine recognizes, of course, that unless there's some structure to the child, you won't do anything with data, right? Unless there's some structure to the embryo, the nutrition won't have any effect. Well, what's the structure of the child? Quine simply stipulates the structure of the child. He doesn't regard it as a matter that requires evidence, which is a curious move, because you're talking about something real, the structure of the child. If somebody makes a proposal about the visual system, and says, I think it has such and such a property. Like, I think it determines structure from motion, or I think it has line detectors, or whatever. They're expected to give evidence, otherwise nobody pays any attention. You can come up with any crazy idea you like. You know. But in this case, somehow you don't have to give evidence, you just stipulate it. And the stipulations are the ones I mentioned yesterday. There's a quality space. It's a space, which means it has a kind of a metric in it, meaning there are things like, he doesn't say exactly what they are, but presumably the kind of elementary, you know, properties of things like color and size and shape and loudness and so on, and then some measure that tells you how close things are, which allows a degree of generalization, you know, so you generalize from one point to a close point. there is, as Karma pointed out yesterday, conditioning. There's the ascent-descent experiment. The child is allowed one experiment, namely asking, is this a so-and-so? That's the experiment the child's allowed. there's elementary induction, meaning simple induction. So if a thing has happened a lot of times, it'll probably happen again, that kind of thing. And tacitly, this is never discussed, but I discussed it last time. Tacitly, there is some linguistics. Now, we don't know exactly what, because it's tacit, it's never stated, but it's at least phonology. And apparently also morphology. If you look, here's a question of interpretation of texts. Now we're talking about something like interpreting Gothic texts or something. you know, you see what's written and you try to figure out what the person has in mind, you know, because it's not stated. And what seems, if you look at the texts, you find presuppositions about morphological structure, you know, inflections and plural and things like that. They seem to come from somewhere, and the child has them. So apparently the child has morphology. The child somehow allowed to pick up words, and I don't know, maybe something about sentences, I'm not sure. But some range of things are given tacitly. We're not told why. You can just see from reading the text that they're assumed. Well, that's the radical translation paradigm. The next crucial aspect to it is that the linguist is identified with the child. Actually, there's a further point, which I didn't mention yesterday, but I'll talk about now. The person in communication situation, meaning, let's say, you and I when we're talking, is also identified with the child, hence the linguist. So all three of these are the same. All three of them require use of the radical translation paradigm. With regard to the child, the radical translation paradigm is a theory, or would be a theory if it was filled out and if the incoherences were removed. If you could explain what you mean by going to the set of well-formed formulas, and if you could fill in these tacit assumptions, and if you would spell out the quality space, and so on and so forth, then you would have a theory of the child, right or wrong. I mean, in fact, so obviously wrong that nobody would even bother, no scientist would even look at it, as is always going to be the case when you simply stipulate a theory. I mean, if I were off the top of my head to stipulate a theory of the visual system, the chances that it would have anything to do with reality would be zero. And the chances that this one has anything to do with reality are also zero. And insofar as it's clear, it's not completely clear, so you can't really test it, but insofar as it's clear, it's just flat wrong in every respect. That's why nobody who, say, works on language acquisition, it's a big field of language acquisition, but nobody pays any attention to this model, because it's so totally wrong in such obvious ways that there's no point in pursuing it. But strikingly, it's arbitrary. It's stipulated. And that itself is a very sharp departure from naturalism. Now, when I say it's arbitrary, I don't mean that it has no historical sources. It does have historical sources, and here we get into a matter of kind of, you know, hermeneutics or something, exegesis, trying to figure out what's in the back of people's minds. And in this case, it's not very obscure. What's in the back of Quine's mind, I suppose, is formal arithmetic, or, you know, formal systems, like, say, arithmetic. If you want to set up a system of arithmetic in the modern period, say, 20th century, if you take a course in metamathematics or foundations of mathematics or something like that, you'll start off by defining something called a language, although it has none of the properties of natural language. This is just a metaphor. In fact, it's radically different from natural language in all of its respects, but it's a metaphor. It's called a language, so okay. And the language is formed by picking some symbols, you know, like plus and zero and successor and so on. So you pick a bunch of symbols and you list them. You say, here's the symbols of the language. That's the phonology, if you like. And then you have an operation called concatenation, which allows you to string these things together. So you can get something like zero, you know, times, let's say you're allowed three, which is really zero with a couple of strokes after it. Equals, you know, 15, or, you know, left-right parenthesis. I mean, you can string together various symbols. That's a mathematical operation which you can define. And then you give a criterion which picks out a class of well-formed formulas. You say among all these strings, there's a certain infinite class which are well-formed formulas, like 2 plus 3 equals 17 is a well-formed formula, but left parenthesis plus right parenthesis equals 3 or something isn't a well-formed formula. And you give a criterion for that, and that's a mathematical operation. It's like defining the set of even numbers, let's say. And that's your language. This is now the language. And then you can pick one or another generative procedure, anyone you feel like, to characterize that infinite set. Like you can pick a particular you know, system that'll form the things, or you can pick some other one. And indeed, it is indeterminate. It doesn't make any difference which one you pick. You do the same thing within the class of well-formed formulas. You may want to make a further distinction between those that are theorems and those that are not theorems. So this one isn't a theorem. But if I had five over here, it would have been a theorem. And you want to make a distinction between those, and then the class of theorems can also be characterized by some procedure, and that procedure is called an axiom system. And again, you can pick it any way you like. As long as it gets the right class of theorems, you can pick it any way you like. And then you can ask very interesting questions. Like, for example, you can give an interpretation of the system under which some of the well-formed formulas are true, and you can ask whether the truths are the same as the theorems. And when you pursue these questions, you reach some quite spectacular mathematical discoveries, some of the great discoveries of modern mathematics, for example, the unformalizability of the notion truth due to Gödel and others. So it's by no means a trivial subject. It's one of the major subjects of modern mathematics with enormous implications, but it runs sort of like that. Now, if that's the model you have in mind, you can sort of understand what Quine's thinking about, because in that model, it's quite true that you specify the language, so-called, it's in quotes, you know, in metaphoric language, as a class of well-formed formulas, and then you pick the generative procedure, the grammar, any way you feel like, and what are the theorems depends on all sorts of things, you know, beliefs about the world, this and that, and they'll be modified as your beliefs get modified, and there's no, you know, definite set of them. You could pick an axiom system one way, you could pick another way. Even for systems as simple as arithmetic, it's a remarkable fact that there is no way to give an axiom system that captures our notion of natural number. Any axiom system that you construct is consistent with what are called non-standard models, that is, classes of things which don't have the properties of the natural numbers. So even something as simple as the natural numbers can't really be characterized. You can see why people who know all of this stuff would be led to theories about indeterminacy for something as complicated as language. The trouble is it just has nothing to do with it, you know. I mean, it has no relationship at all. It's just, from the very first step, it has no relationship. The structure of formal arithmetic is radically unlike the structure of natural language. And furthermore, these are creations of the mind. Natural language isn't a creation of the mind any more than your arms are a creation of the mind. It's just a form that the brain takes under certain conditions. It's not something you create by thinking about it. I mean, this is like a painting, if you like. You know? You just create it. And it's interesting to know how people create things, and, you know, then you can ask all kind of questions about what the nature of mathematical truth is, and, you know, all kind of interesting topics. But it's a different field. The study of language is like embryology. It's just the study of how the brain takes a certain form under certain conditions. And any mathematical analogies are just totally irrelevant. You know, it's not any point pursuing them. The people think there's a formal language in natural language, I suppose, because there is a formal language in the case of arithmetic, and there is because you stipulated it to be so. You stipulated the class of well-formed formulas, just like, you know, if you're doing number theory, you could stipulate the class of prime numbers. It's the same sort of thing. And therefore it exists, because you stipulated it. But you can't stipulate things in the natural world. They're either there or they're not there. You know, you can't say they're there, because I say so. That doesn't work in studying the natural world. So carrying over these analogies and models is very misleading. Now, remember, what I've just been saying is an interpretation of what I think is in the back of the minds of people who create these systems. They don't say so. But I'm just guessing as to what's in the back of their minds, which could lead to a picture so totally incoherent and so totally arbitrary and stipulative and anti-naturalist. So I'm kind of trying to make up a story that would make it intelligible and understandable that smart people who know mathematics could be so misled when they're studying the natural world. Maybe that's the right story, maybe it's the wrong story. I mean, that's a matter for the biographers. But those are the questions that ought to be raised in intellectual biography if it was ever done by people who aren't just hagiographers, you know, which is rare. You know. But anyhow, that's the picture, whatever the source may be. Now we have to somehow try to make sense out of it, since it doesn't make sense itself. Well, it has various problems. One problem is that the output, class of well-formed formulas, is a completely crazy output. There's no such thing, as far as we know, and there couldn't be such a thing as an output unless there was an explicit, fixed, intentional characterization of it, that is, an I language. And since the existence of the I language is denied, we're in total incoherence. So, one, the output of the system is crazy. A second thing that's problematic about the theory of radical translation is that the internal state is crazy. So the output's crazy, the internal state is crazy, not because it couldn't be that way. See, the output couldn't be that way. There couldn't be a possible organism which has that output, namely storing an infinite set without a finite characterization of it. That can't be the case. So the output is just incoherent. The internal structure is not incoherent. You could design an organism which has those properties. That is, it has these properties. It's just that there isn't any such organism around. In fact, none remotely resembling it. What's crazy about the internal state is the idea of stipulating an internal state. The internal state of a complex organism is a very hard thing to understand. You want to understand what makes a chicken embryo turn into a chicken. You got to do a lot of work. You want to understand what causes a human to grow arms and legs and not wings. You have to do a lot of work. And you're not going to have to do less work than that to determine what makes the human brain turn into a human language. So the idea that you could stipulate any of these things is just outlandish. The third thing that's crazy is the identification of the linguist with the child, because their situations are totally different. The linguist coming to investigate the jungle language, as Quine puts it, is not at all in the epistemic situation of the child. The epistemic situation of the child is the child comes already equipped with the innate knowledge of what a possible language is. That's there in the head, somehow. The child comes to the language acquisition problem knowing tacitly that there's a certain class of possible answers, small class of possible answers, in fact, very small. And the child picks out one of those answers, one I language. That's the epistemic problem for the child. The epistemic problem for the linguist is totally different. The linguist is trying to find out what is the epistemic state of the child. That's the linguist's problem. So on the one hand, the linguist does want to find out what the child ends up with, like you want to know what's the structure of Catalan. But the more interesting question, the one that one's really interested in, is what is the structure of language, which is a question about, you know, the question sometimes called universal grammar, which is simply the question, what's the initial state of the child? So the task of the linguist is to discover the epistemic state that the child begins with, to insist that the linguist approach that problem by being in the epistemic state of the child doesn't make any sense. In fact, the linguist, as I say, will use any data at all. The linguist won't be restricted to this data. Why should he be? You know, the linguist will certainly use data from other languages. In fact, every linguist always does that. If somebody's studying Catalan and they have two choices as to how to handle causative constructions, they'll ask questions about how causative constructions work in other languages. Make perfect sense. Because however they work, it's being determined by the internal state, and if you have evidence about it from Japanese, that's going to bear on Catalan, obviously. But that's excluded here. If anything were discovered, say, about ERPs, say, electrical activity of the brain, a linguist would be happy to use that as evidence. If anything's discovered about the theory of cells, fine, use that. Use anything. You're certainly not restricted to this database. And you can't be in the epistemic, and you're not in the epistemic situation of the child. A person inquiring into the nature of the epistemic state isn't in that epistemic state. You're using some other capacities of the mind, the capacities that you use when you try to understand quantum physics. Those are the capacities that you're using when you try to understand this. Right, like when you're trying to figure out quantum physics, you don't use these capacities, even if they existed. In fact, you also don't use the actual capacities of the child. When you're trying to understand quantum physics, you don't use universal grammar, whatever it is. That's just irrelevant. You know, you use whatever the relevant aspects of our science-forming abilities are, and those are the very same aspects that you'll use in trying to answer the question, what's this epistemic state? So the picture has three forms of craziness, if you like. One, the output, which is incoherent. Two, the input, which is stipulative and wrong. And three, the assumption that the linguist is in the epistemic state of the child, which doesn't make any sense at all. So it seems to me that this entire picture has just nothing in it that can be resurrected. And any conclusions that follow from it are valueless because it can't get off the ground. Now, very far-reaching conclusions are drawn from this about the theory of meaning and, you know, people and so on and so forth. And it's a highly influential paradigm. But as far as I can see, it's about as remote from naturalism as anything you can imagine. In every respect, completely off base. Let me just finally add the thing that I forgot to mention last time, the identification of the person in the communication situation with the child. The idea is we have two people talking, let's say Peter and Mary, and the question is, how do they proceed to communicate? Well, according to Quinean view, they essentially proceed by radical translation. Okay, that's the only thing they can do. So Peter has that set of qualities, and Mary has that set of qualities, and maybe they're allowed some guess. Maybe they've already achieved some kind of language. That's not clear, you know. It's not stated, so I don't know what to say about that. And then they try to communicate. Peter hears Mary say, "Gavagai," and tries to figure out whether that's rabbit or rabbit stage. That's the story. Okay. So the person in the communication situation is like the child. Notice again that this is radically different from the way we study any other kind of communication. There are a lot of other communication problems that people study all the time. So there's questions about how cells communicate. They do. You know, you have two cells over here, and you want to know how they interact. They do. They interact in all kinds of ways. You never study cellular interaction by stipulating something like a radical translation paradigm and saying, that's how it works, because I say so. You know, I mean, it would be idiotic to consider. Or suppose you're studying, say, ants, which also communicate chemically, or say bees, which have something which is sometimes called a language, but that's again just a metaphor. You know, just some everything from cells on up has some kind of communication system. In the case of bees, it's called a language, but that's, you could just as well call it that for cells, or ants, or anything else, or let's say, you know, chimpanzees or birds or whatever. I mean, there's all kind of work, interesting work in biology that studies communication between systems. And the way it works is always the same. You try to discover what's the internal state of this system. You know, what is its internal state? And you ask two questions about it. First of all, what is it? And then how did it get there? So those are the basic questions. If you're studying a communication situation, you want to know what's the internal state of the entity in it, and how did that internal state arise? I mean, that's standard science. And in fact, that's the way you do it for cells, ants, bees, chimps, birds, and so on and so forth. But when we get to humans, we're not allowed to do it anymore. That's the same dualism suddenly arises. When we get to humans, we're not allowed to ask, what's the internal state of Peter? What's the internal state of Mary? How do those internal states affect their interaction? And how did those internal states develop? Right? The questions we would ask about everything else from the level of cells up to humans, we're not allowed to ask here. Rather, we have to assume that the epistemic state of Susan and of Peter and Mary is what is stipulated by the philosopher. There's nothing in the history of philosophy as irrational as this. I mean, there are a lot of irrational things in the history of philosophy back for thousands of years. You know, people have made stipulations about the natural world. But I can't think of anything as irrational as this. You go back to the earliest period, the stipulations about the natural world were sort of speculations based on current understanding. So, you know, Democritus and Adams was a speculation based on current understanding. I mean, you saw that if you poured oil on water, it didn't extend forever. Okay, so you think, okay, there must be discrete particles or something, which is quite good reasoning, in fact. And in fact, quite generally, concepts, speculations about the world, or say Hume speculated that the springs and origins of human understanding, as he called it, involved certain principles of association and so on. Okay, it's a theory, you know, not unreasonable. Wrong, but not unreasonable. But anything, I think you have to look very far to find anything as irrational as this. You might try, but I think it's unique in the history of thought, in fact, in the level of irrationality that it's reached. And strikingly, there is no internal critique of it. People, just very smart people, you know, really smart, sophisticated people, pursue it as if it makes sense, without any serious questions being raised about it. Maybe what I'm saying is completely wrong. You ought to certainly take that possibility very seriously, because it's a very strange thing if it's correct. But if it's correct, you know, it does require explanation. There's another aspect of this, which I mentioned a little bit yesterday, and that is the willingness to, in the case of Gavagai, the willingness to allow, which is the standard example, you know, the one example, the willingness to allow the child, the linguist, and Peter in the communication situation, to allow them to pick out the phonology of the word. They're allowed to pick out the phonology of the word Gavagai. They're not allowed to pick out the meaning of the word, rabbit. Rather, there's indeterminacy about the meaning. Well, that's an asymmetry which requires explanation, because, as we know, picking out the phonology is no trivial matter. In fact, it's a sophisticated matter, and in fact, there really is underdetermination, really is. The child's or the linguist's first hearing of the signal, you know, even just writing the phonetic transcription of the signal, already brings to bear a rich theoretical apparatus based on universal phonetics. But even when we get beyond that, we know perfectly well that what range of variation falls within what we will ultimately call the word Gavagai for a particular language is underdetermined by the first signal, certainly. In fact, it requires building up a pattern and a system and meeting certain formal conditions and so on and so forth. So there are problems there, but somehow we're allowed to get over those, and maybe over the morphological ones and so on. Well, again, no reason is given as to why we're allowed to do those things, but not do what amount to comparable things in the case on the semantic side. On the semantic side, there's supposed to be lethal indeterminacy. There is no truth to the question of whether Gavagai means rabbit or rabbit stage. But there is a truth to the question about whether, you know, Gavagai and Kepeki or something are the same word. There's a truth to that question, but not to the question of the meaning. Well, that requires explanation, because they're similar problems. And in fact, we have probably better evidence in the case of rabbit and rabbit stage than in the other case. Well, that question, again, is not addressed. And we might ask why. And again, we have to just try exegesis. And my guess is the one that I suggested yesterday. There's a tendency, as you get closer to the traditional mind, the traditional soul, there's a tendency to veer off into irrationality for whatever reason. So therefore, you kind of presuppose the rational assumption in the case of the phonetics, which is far enough away not to bother anybody. You're not allowed to presuppose the rational steps when you get closer to the semantics. Now, actually, I say an argument is needed, and in fact, one is given at this point. It's worth saying that. But the argument that's given is the theory of meaning holism. This is a notion that comes in various strengths, you know, how holistic meaning is. The least strength is that, which almost everybody in the field accepts, that the meaning of a word doesn't have meaning in isolation. Okay, a word has meaning only in the context of a sentence. These are the relevant contexts for determining meaning. So a weak version of meaning holism is that only in the context of a sentence does a word have meaning. You first learn sentences, and then you kind of abstract away the meaning. A richer theory is that a word has meaning only in the context of a language. A still richer theory is that a word has meaning only in the context of what's sometimes called a theory, meaning a total belief system of which the language is a part. Okay. Now, Quine actually, crucially, and one of his crucial ideas is this one, that a language has, or a word, any word, has meaning only in the context of a theory. That's the extreme version of meaning holism. And if that's, that could be true, after all, that's a substantive proposal, hence could be true. And if it's true, then it's correct that there would be a distinction between, that if it's true, that would give an argument for the distinction between sound and meaning, because sound is not supposed to be subject to this kind of holism. Well, we might ask, in fact, whether sound is subject, could be subject. Well, let's take a look at the arguments and see if sound could be subject to that kind of holism. So, for example, take a... there's a recent book on meaning holism, an interesting book by Fodor, Jerry Fodor, and Ernie Lepore, called Meaning Holism. And they ultimately, they don't actually reject the idea, but the book is a critical analysis of the idea, so they're not advocating it. They're just considering various reasons why it looks plausible and showing problems with those reasons. Okay, that's their purpose, and it's quite an interesting book. They start the book by saying why meaning holism looks so plausible. In fact, they say it looks even obvious, which is hence, you know, setting forth their own project. They say, look, here's this idea which looks totally obvious, but nevertheless we're going to show some problems in it. That's the project. Well, the reason it looks obvious is essentially that story. They say, take a word, like, say, take the word bark. Well, obviously, it means something different if I say I peeled the bark off the tree or the dog barked. Okay, so therefore, the meaning of a word is determined by the sentence. Okay, we've shown that. Or take, say, flying planes, another example that from the literature that they give. If you put it in the context, is dangerous, it means one thing. If you put it in the context, are dangerous, it means another thing. So therefore, the meaning of a word depends on the sentence. We've established at least the weak form of meaning holism. What about the stronger form? They say, well, consider the expression. I'll have to write it in some neutral form. So let me write it in English, because we want to be neutral across languages here. I'll write it in English with the quotes around it, meaning abstracting from English. So they say, take the expression, Empedocles leaped. No, let's put brackets around it to mean we're abstracting that expression from English. You know. And they say, well, that expression, Empedocles, named philosopher, you know, leaped means jumped off a mountain or something. They say, if you take the sentence Empedocles leaped in English, it means the philosopher jumped off the mountain. If you take the sentence Empedocles leaped in German, where you would spell this like this, but they say the same sentence, then it means Empedocles loved somebody. Okay. So therefore, we've shown that the meaning of a word is dependent on the language. Okay. And what about the dependence on a theory? Well, you know, here there are standard arguments given by everybody. People say, look, take the word momentum. At one time, it meant whatever it meant, you know, mass time, whatever it is, mass times acceleration or something. And at a later stage of physics, it was just given a different meaning. In fact, the definition of it in the early stage turns out to be false in the new stage. So that's a radical change in meaning as theory changes. Or take, say, atom. It meant one thing to Democritus, and it meant something else to Dalton, and something else to Niels Bohr, and something else to quantum theory. So the meaning of the word changes as time goes on. So therefore, the meaning of a word is dependent on an entire belief system. That's the argument. Okay. There are various points finessed here, like, say, why Empedocles leaped is the same sentence in English and German, but let's forget that. The question is, how strong an argument is this? I mean, could we, for example, give a theory of sound? Then the argument is, well, look, we've shown, see, once you've established meaning holism, then you've essentially said the study of meaning is hopeless. You know, because if the meaning of a word is going to depend on sentences and languages and whole theories and so on and so forth, then forget it. There's never going to be, it's like a theory of everything. No, in order to find the meaning of a word, you'll have to know everything. Well, okay, that's the same as saying there's no study. The topic is finished. Now we've demonstrated that there is a real difference between sound and meaning. And that's what lies behind all of this stuff. I mean, the radical translation paradigm and everything else is supposed to sort of give you the rationale for the theory of meaning holism. Well, just try to construct the theory of sound holism and see what that would look like. First of all, notice that what do people mean when they say the word bark has a different meaning in different sentences? What's the word that has a different meaning? Well, presumably by the word, they mean the collection of phonological properties. Okay, they would say, or maybe the letters or something like that. But the physical, you know, the output side of the word, the signal side of the word, is what they mean by the word. But that's a funny notion of word. I mean, the word bark in English isn't just a bunch of sounds. The word bark in English is a collection of a bunch of sounds and a bunch of meanings. Okay, that's the word bark. There's a, you know, Saussurean connection between the sound and the meaning. And you have no word unless you have the connection. So that a word is what I call a linguistic expression, which is just a collection of properties. Some of them are sound properties. Some of them are meaning properties. Some of them are structural properties, like bark is, you know, either a noun or a verb, let's say, but not an adjective. All of those are properties. The word is just the collection of all those properties. Now, if you extract the meaning properties, then you can run through this argument and you can get a theory of meaning holism. But just mechanically, we could do it the other way around. We could leave the meaning properties and cut out the sound properties. Now it's harder to talk about it because it's harder to talk about a word without giving a sound, but that's, you know, just a difficulty. So we could spell it, say. And then we could ask whether the, let's call it the non-phonological word bark, meaning bark with all of its properties, but divested of the fact that it begins with a bilabial stop and so on and so forth. Bark divested of the sound properties. We could say, just as we said that bark divested of its meaning properties has different meanings in different sentences, it has a different meaning depending where it is in the sentence or something. We can say that non-phonological bark has a different sound depending where it's placed in the sentence, which is quite true. If you say the word bark in the beginning of a sentence, you say it differently from the way you say it at the end of a sentence. So therefore, the sound of bark depends on where it is in a sentence. Okay. Thinking of bark now as just the thing divorced from its phonetics. Similarly, Empedocles leaped. If we take this expression, now we have to pick one language, so let's pick English. If we take the entire conceptual structure of the philosopher, jumped off the mountain, and we divorce it from the sound part, we can say that Empedocles leaped sounds one way in English and sounds a different way in Catalan. Okay, so therefore the sound of Empedocles leaped depends on the language. Okay. And in fact, we could probably go up to theories if we like. So we've got a theory of sound holism. The sound of a word depends at least on the entire language, which means it's completely hopeless to study sound. We can throw away phonology. There's no hope any longer in carrying out phonological investigation, because in order to study the sound of a word, we have to know the whole language. That's the same argument. Well, obviously that's absurd. And the argument is no better in the other case. So we have no argument for meaning holism, which doesn't mean it's false, like maybe it's true. But at least that line of argument won't work, because the very same line of the argument is based crucially on taking a word to be a collection of properties minus the meaning. And if you do that, you can establish meaning holism. If you take the collection of properties minus the sound, you can establish sound holism in the same fashion. But that's just, you know, a trick. And since we don't take the sound holism property seriously, and conclude that phonology is a hopeless subject because you know the whole language or maybe even the whole theory before you study the sound of a single word, there's no reason to take the meaning holism theory seriously, at least on those grounds. Now, again, that doesn't mean it's false. You know, the fact that an argument given for it doesn't work doesn't mean that it's false. Maybe it's true. What about the last part, that words change meaning as theories change. Well, that's a notion that's extremely hard to state, even. I mean, when we say that Adam meant one thing for Democritus and something else for Niels Bohr, what exactly are we saying? What is that word, Adam, that was shared by Democritus and Niels Bohr? Well, there's no real answer to that. I mean, you know, they're talking different languages. I mean, they put it in different contexts. It's a very mystical notion. This relates to something I mentioned the first day about the free and easy talk that people give about words changing meaning or changing sound and so on. That doesn't really mean anything much. I mean, you can get away with it in normal discourse where precision isn't very important. But when you try to give we're out of normal discourse now. We're trying to give a theoretical account of something. And when you do that, you have to be much more careful about what you're saying. And now you've got to give a sense to the concept, words change meaning or words change sound. And there is no sense to that concept. Now notice there's an interpretation of all of this in I language terms that makes perfect sense. To say that a word changes meaning over time is to say that if you take successive I languages, they differ in some, and you draw sort of a line, you know, a line through them at that particular word, you'll find that that element has a different position in the system in different times. You can do that. It's a little bit like saying giraffes evolve longer necks. I mean, we can say that informally, but of course, you know, it doesn't mean that there's a thing giraffe which had a short neck once and has a long neck later. I mean, what it means is the distribution of neck lengths was such and such at one period, and the distribution of neck lengths was some other thing at a different period. That's what we're saying when we say that giraffes evolved longer necks. Now, as long as we're not confused about the matter, there's nothing wrong with saying giraffes evolved longer necks. But if some, say, philosopher came along and said, okay, there's an entity, giraffe, you know, and giraffes used to have short necks, and now giraffes have long necks, and a process called evolution took place between them, that person would be going into outer space, you know. They'd be entering into total confusion. Because all that happened, these are just shorthand ways of saying the distribution of traits changed over time. And that's what's involved when you say a word changes meaning or a word changes sound and so on. If somebody said, ask the question, is a giraffe now the same as what it was, you know, whenever giraffes started a couple millennia ago, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, all we can say is, yeah, there was a bunch of organisms then, and there are a bunch now, and there's a kind of a strange, complicated historical connection between them, and that's the end of the story. There's no question as to whether today's giraffes are some version of earlier giraffes. That's not a question. You know. And similarly, to ask whether Adam for Bohr is the same as Adam for Democritus is just not a question. They spoke different I languages. The I languages matched in certain respects, and we'll find certain similarities between them, and maybe those similarities will be enough so that we'll decide to pick a point in one system and say, okay, it's roughly the same as a point in another system, but that's all you can say. It's like giraffes and necks. Okay. So the entire question is being posed in a way which doesn't make a lot of sense and is requires a good deal of clarification. That's clear how to give the clarification, at least in I-language terms. But once you give the clarification, the problem dissolves. You know, now there's no longer any question about whether the word meaning, the word changed. It's not the same word, you know, any more than Mount Everest is. It's like the question that I mentioned last time. You pick some mountain, and there's an avalanche, and a lot of stuff falls off it, and you ask, is it the same mountain? Well, that's not a meaningful question. You know, it's depends on what your interests are. That'll determine whether it's the same mountain or not. It's obviously not the same physical object. If your current concerns as to how to individuate mountains are such that they're similar enough, okay, it's the same mountain. If not, not. But these are questions of decision, not fact. Similarly with the same word. Now, notice that a second point to notice about these examples of the theory holism is that the examples that are given are almost always from natural science. Okay, so it's not the word, let's say, fall that's given. I mean, let's take a sentence that we use in ordinary English. Even one talking about a relatively technical problem. So suppose I say, the missile rose from the ground and then fell back to the ground. Okay, we know what that means to describe it. That's relatively technical talk already. You know, it's not like John loves Mary or something like that. Nevertheless, notice that the meaning of the words is not part of natural science. I mean, we know in some other corner of our heads, first of all, there's no such thing in the natural world as the ground. I mean, if you ask a geologist, say, where's the ground? You know, well, you know, that doesn't mean anything. Suppose I actually say, make it even worse, and say, the missile rose toward the heavens. And then fell back to the ground. Well, there certainly isn't anything called the heavens. Okay? Just went up in the air somewhere. So the missile rose toward the heavens and then went down to the ground. There's no heavens and there's no ground. Furthermore, rose is wrong. What we know actually happened is the missile pushed the earth down a little bit, and the earth pushed the missile up a little bit, and the missile having much less mass than the earth, the difference from the initial position is greater from the missile than the earth. But they just pushed each other away. And when the missile fell down, all that happened is they pulled each other. The missile pulled the earth up a little bit, and the earth pulled the missile down a little bit. And in fact, if you really get fancy, what happened is some geodesic through curved space-time. You know. That's what happened. But nevertheless, we understand all of this fine. Notice that the words of ordinary English didn't change meaning as theories changed. I mean, there was a time when people would have said it that way, and they would have meant it. They would have meant there's a thing up there called the heavens, and there's a thing down here called the ground, and the missile went up from the ground to the heavens. That's what in fact happened, and then it fell back from the heavens to the ground. That would have been their science. Okay, there was a time when that was science. Right. Now it's not. It's not our science. Our theories have changed radically. In the scientific part of our minds, we say. As I say, if we're really fancy, we say something about geodesics and curved space-time. And if we're not quite that fancy, we say that the Earth and the collection of mass particles, another collection of particles pushed each other apart and then pulled each other back together. Okay, that's it. But the language hasn't changed at all. None of the meanings of the words has changed as theory has changed. And that's quite typical. In contrast, in connection with words like momentum and atom, the meaning has changed. That is, there is no longer any term in scientific language that corresponds to what Democritus meant by atom. The language of science has no such term anymore. In fact, it has no such term as what Niels Bohr meant by atom, because the theory has changed enough so that that notion isn't around anymore. Some other notion is around. We can say that new notion is sort of a kind of a descendant of the Bohr atom, just as today's giraffe may be a descendant of some earlier giraffe. But that's kind of a metaphoric shorthand for something much more complicated, for something about the comparability of points in two different systems. The point of examples like this is to illustrate that the argument about meaning holism based on change of theory works for natural science if we reinterpret it rationally, as meaning we give up certain forms of theory and we adopt new forms of theory, sometimes using the same word, and sometimes with enough match between them. And there's no metric for this, it's just a matter of decision, but enough similarity between them so that we'll say the new atom is a new version of the old atom, just like we might say that the mountain after the avalanche is the same as the mountain before the avalanche. But there's no substantive meaning to that identification. It's just a shorthand for, helping people know what to look for in the old theory to see where the new theory came from. Okay, it's like the evolution of giraffe necks. On the other hand, for natural language, the theory of meaning holism just seems flat false. I mean, if we look at natural language, we see, in fact, that the terms have retained all of their old meanings as theory has radically changed. And it doesn't matter how sophisticated a physicist you are. You know, you can be the guy who just got the last Nobel Prize, and you'll still say the missile rose from the ground to the heavens and fell back to the earth and mean exactly that, exactly what you and I mean, because the language hasn't changed at all, even though the theory has changed totally. So insofar as the theory of meaning holism, the big theory of meaning holism, the one that makes meaning theory relative, insofar as that's intended to be a substantive comment about our language, it just isn't true. Insofar as it's a comment about scientific language, it's maybe true, but only in the sense in which giraffes evolved longer necks is true. That is a shorthand way of describing some other thing. Now, these issues arise, if there's time later, I'll come back to it, and certainly the philosophers among you at least will know that these questions arise very crucially in connection with contemporary theories of reference, what are called externalist theories of reference. Theories that tell you that the reference of a term, like, say, book or table or something, is determined by the way the world really is. Reference and meaning aren't things in your head. They're things in the world. It's called externalist theories. They're almost universally accepted now. Hilary Putnam is, in fact, one of the originators of these theories. They sort of swept the field in the past 20 years, Putnam, Kripke, and others. Putnam, in talking about the theory, gives the example momentum. He says, look, momentum is a particular thing. They defined it a certain way in the 18th century, and they were just wrong because they didn't capture that thing. Contemporary physics defines it a different way, and you know, maybe they're right. You know. But there's a thing, momentum, and there's a word, momentum, which refers to that thing. And people who were using the word may have been misreferring all the time. So for Putnam, say, there's a real substantive question as to what atom meant pre-Dalton, let's say. And he says what it meant